Good morning, church. Coming at you perhaps a little differently than what you might expect on a Sunday, but we're trying to anticipate the weather. And right now, our crystal ball is not entirely clear. So we've put some things together just in case we're not able to be in the building together on Sunday. I'm so thankful for the technology that lets us do that. And I'm glad that you're watching, given whatever circumstance, whether you're normally with us or normally watching from afar. We're glad for our audience, and we hope that you're blessed today. Last week, if you were able to see the sermon, be with us for the sermon, we talked about Oliver Twist and his little cry of humanity, "I'd like some more." We talked about the two pathways there are to find it. One is the common, wide, crowded path of lies that are sown to us through Satan. We talked about the other one that is much more rare. It is narrow, and it is a lonely path of truth. One way or the other, we're going to try to find that something more. Well, our series continues, and in the next few weeks, we're going to be focusing on lives. We're going to talk about the portraits in the Bible of lives that have been transformed through the revolutionary power of God. A couple of thoughts before we jump in to today's segment. People tend to join a revolution because they want to change things. There is a real danger point that needs to be brought up, because the very first thing a revolution will change is you. So you'd better be careful which revolutions you join. The stories that we're going to look at are different stories, some Old Testament, some New Testament, but they are pictures of lives that have been revolutionized in different ways by God. One other note that I would give you in relation to that is there are a lot of revolutionaries out there. Christ is only one of them. All of them want to change you. Only one of them wants to save you and rescue you. So think about that as we look at these different lives. And maybe in their faces, in their pictures, you'll be able to see your own. Let's start today by reading from the Gospel of John again. Let's back up a few chapters. We've been in 10 the last week or two. Let's go back to John chapter 4, and let's read about a woman at a well. John chapter 4, we'll pick up the story in verse 4. Now Jesus had to go through Samaria, so he came to a town in Samaria called Sychar, near the plot of ground that Jacob had given to his son Joseph. Jacob's well was there, and Jesus, tired as he was from the journey, sat down by the well. It was about the sixth hour. When a Samaritan woman came to draw water, Jesus said to her, "Will you give me a drink?" His disciples had gone into town to buy food. The Samaritan woman said to him, "You are a Jew. I am a Samaritan woman. How can you ask me for a drink? For Jews do not associate with Samaritans." Jesus answered her, "If you knew the gift of God and who it is that asks you for a drink, you would have asked him, and he would have given you living water." "Sir," the woman said, "you have nothing to draw with, and the well is deep. Where can you get this living water? Are you greater than our father Jacob, who gave us the well and drank from it himself, as did also his sons and flocks and herds?" Jesus answered, "Everyone who drinks this water will be thirsty again, but whoever drinks the water I give him will never thirst. Indeed, the water I give him will become in him a spring of water welling up to eternal life." The woman said to him, "Sir, give me this water so I won't get thirsty and have to keep coming here to draw water." He told her, "Go call your husband and come back." "I have no husband," she replied. "You say," Jesus said, "rightly, that you have no husband. The fact is, you have had five husbands, and the man you now have is not your husband. What you have just said is true." "Sir," the woman said, "I can see that you are a prophet. Our fathers worshipped on this mountain, but you Jews claim the place where we must worship is in Jerusalem." Jesus declared, "Believe me, woman, a time is coming when you will worship the Father neither on this mountain nor in Jerusalem. You Samaritans worship what you do not know. We worship what we do know, for salvation is from the Jews. Yet a time is coming and has now come when the true worshipers will worship the Father in spirit and in truth, for they are the kind of worshipers the Father seeks. God is spirit, and his worshipers must worship in spirit and in truth." The woman said, "I know that Messiah, called Christ, is coming. When he comes, he will explain everything to us." Then Jesus declared, "I who speak to you am he." That may be a story that you know. Let's think about it just a little bit. It is a story about longing. It was the hottest time of the day there in Sychar as Jesus walked toward the well just outside of the small town. He no doubt felt the sun beating down on his back from the cloudless sky, felt the sweat trickling down his face and cheek, and now as he walked, he felt the weariness trickling up his legs and back from the tiredness of too many miles. At least at this place, he had, for a change, really nothing to do. God, if you will, killing time. The disciples have run on to town to pick up a 12-pack of chili cheese dogs, and he has just a few moments to himself to rest. These are rare moments for a Messiah. There are no questions to answer. There are no hands to hold, no sick to heal, no pressing crowds. It is a good time to rest, and it's a welcome relief as Jesus sits down on the worn, time-polished rocks which outline the ancient well, a well that has been quenching thirst for over 2,000 years. He and his men have made many miles already this day on their way back to Galilee. As he thinks back over the past weeks, they have been very demanding. At every turn, there have been increasingly massive crowds struggling to get close enough just to see him or to hear him speak, maybe even to touch him. There have been religious authorities at every turn trying to keep him from speaking or challenging his truth. It was nice for him to have a few peaceful moments for himself. Jesus must have sighed deeply as he thought about his mission so far, and then probably sighed more deeply as he thought about what was yet to come. I have to wonder, does God ever get discouraged? Deep in his thoughts, he may not have even seen her coming. Yet, of course, he knew she was and would. This Samaritan woman who suddenly just is there. She's busily, mechanically drawing a day's supply of water for her family's needs, a task that she has done so many times and knows so well. Why is she here alone? Jesus wonders and knows at the same time. She tries to avoid his glance. Why is this Jewish man here alone? She wonders and she tries not to meet his penetrating gaze, but for some reason she cannot not look into his eyes. Eyes unlike any of those of the men she has known. In his eyes there was no hunger, no demand, no condescension, nothing to fear. And he seemed able to look beyond her puffy, bloodshot eyes all the way into her tired, frayed soul. It made her a bit uncomfortable, but mostly it made her curious. She was not prepared for what happened next. He asked her for a drink of water. He spoke to her. Men, at least respectable men, did not usually speak to women in public, and certainly not the kind of woman she was reputed to be. And Jewish men never spoke to Samaritan women at all. In her shock, she speaks her mind. How can you ask me for a drink? And his answer puzzles her even more and lays the groundwork for the discussion that will follow. Jesus says, if you knew who you were talking to, you would be asking me for a drink, and I would give you living water. Jesus, of course, is speaking figuratively. She is thinking literally. They aren't on the same page yet. But she is intrigued, and she is thirsty for this living water. She needs and she wants the peace and security and fulfillment that we all want. She wants the answers and directions that all of us want. And she knows that she is thirsty for something more. She came to this place for water, but in her life and condition, her emptiness was deeper than even this well. And it is there at the well that she found more than she ever dreamed possible. Just a few verses on in the story, beyond where we stopped, she becomes one of the very first missionaries of the gospel of Jesus Christ. She becomes a revolutionary now herself, transformed by Jesus. I've always loved that story. And there are so many possible directions you could go in teaching about this one. Maybe a lesson on prejudice, Jews and Samaritans, the tensions there. We understand the problems of prejudice and racial disharmony. We could talk about love for the unlovely. We could talk about Jesus' effect on people. He always had this way of disarming them by his love, and they became in his presence secure enough to realize and accept the truth. We could talk about just being open to the moment, because Jesus is there, as so often we are there, and we're not really paying attention to what's going on around us, but God is at work. But I'm not going to talk about any of those today. I want us to look at this story as a story of thirst and longing. Let's leave her here for a moment at the well, and let's focus on ourselves. Isn't it true that just like Oliver Twist, all of us long for something more? Isn't it true that all of us are thirsty for something? We all really want the same things. We want fulfillment and peace and meaning and purpose and answers and direction, the same things that she wanted. There's so many different specific things that we as humans thirst after. You stop to think about it, almost anyone you know, well, you probably know what they're after in life if you know them very well at all. You don't have to know someone even particularly well to be able to see what it is they're thirsty for. It's what drives them. It's what thrills them and excites them. It's what torments them and entertains them. It's what ultimately and always defines them. Kind of an interesting question then to ask people that you know, or people who know you. From what they see in your life, what would they say you are after in life? What would they identify as your thirst? Ask them. Ask your friends, your mates, your children, even if you're brave enough, because they probably will know. The question of thirst is a big question. Maybe even more important is the question of how we're going to quench our thirst. It's an important question, and the answer is an important answer, because I would suggest to you today that our lives are identified, they are defined by these very thirsts and longings. We all have them. I'm going to date myself here, which I do more and more these days, but some of you remember Popeye? Popeye and spinach, right? Even if you can't remember anything else about Popeye, he was the sailor man who loved spinach. Popeye had a friend named Wimpy, and Wimpy was always going around, and his longing was very obvious. Wimpy was always telling someone, "For a hamburger today, I will gladly repay you on Thursday." That was Wimpy's line. There was no question about his longing and his agenda. Dickens' Ebenezer Scrooge says, "There's no such thing as too much, only having too little." His agenda was clear. We started off with Oliver Twist last week asking, "Please, sir, can I have some more?" And that's what I think so many people are looking for. They're not sure exactly what they want or what they need, but they know innately that there must be something more. Our agendas, our cravings, our hungers and thirsts and longings, these define who we are. Each of them in their own way are revolutionaries seeking to control and own and change us for the good or for the bad. Well, let's stray a little further away from the well at Sychar. And let me take you to another story, this one not so much about a person as it is about a people, a resistant people. Very interesting story. I don't know whether to call this story comically tragic or tragically comical. It is in the book of Numbers. It's in chapter 11 of Numbers, if you want to turn there. In these verses is contained a really important lesson about longings. Let me set it up for you. The Israelites we find here are in the desert. They have been wandering, been out there for a while now, I think about 2 years. Okay, so not very far into their 40 years, but 2 years is a long time to be in the desert. Verse 4 of chapter 11 tells us that the rabble with them began to crave other food. Now, from that little verse, you can learn a thing or two. One thing is, some of the people are probably quite content. But some of the people among them, the rabble, it calls them, are beginning to whine and moan. It's a really small tremor, okay? Just a trickle of complaining, evidently. But, you know, that's where most problems begin, whether it's in marriages or churches or families. It's a small tremor. There's a real tension in these words. God has fed them. You remember the story? God has fed them with manna for a long time now. It comes to them every single day, but some of them are tired of it. And again, the Israelites started wailing, and they said, "If only we had meat to eat. We remember the fish we ate in Egypt, also the cucumbers, melons, leeks, onions, and garlic. Now we never see anything but this manna." And it's almost like there's a spit and a disgust at that point. You may remember in the Hebrew language, the word manna means, what the heck is this stuff? It came miraculously. It fell on the ground like dew each night, and they went out and gathered it every morning. It was everything that they needed. Okay, verse 10, by the time we get there, the infection has spread. It's not just the rabble. Here's what it says. Moses heard the people of every family wailing, each at the entrance to his tent, and the Lord became exceedingly angry, and Moses was troubled. I can understand that. There are a few times in my ministry when I've been more troubled than when people within the church are grumbling. In this circumstance, Moses has to wonder, what am I supposed to do? Well, Moses starts grumbling. Moses starts wailing. "Why have you brought this trouble on me? What have I done to displease you, Lord, that you put the burden of all these people on me?" That's not an especially unusual lament of prophets and pastors. Moses doesn't stop. He keeps on wailing. "Did I conceive all these people? Did I give them birth? Why do you tell me to carry them in my arms as a nurse carries an infant to the land you promised on oath to their forefathers? Where can I get meat for all these people? I cannot carry these people by myself. The burden is too heavy for me." Wow, Moses. It's a bad day for poor Moses. And if you remember, Moses never really wanted the job anyway. Well, God has provided manna for these people every single day, miraculously. It is the perfect food, top, middle, and bottom of the food pyramid, each fat and preservative-free, Atkins-approved serving containing 100% of the minimum daily requirements for good nutrition. But whether it was miraculous or not is now beside the point. They are tired of manna. Kind of an irony here. It was all they really needed. God was giving them everything that they really needed. But for them, it was not enough. Kind of reminds me of our culture sometimes when we are so affluent. We have so much, but we're bored even with our bounty. Notice here, the people are specific about what they're hungry for. They want some meat. They want some onions. They are defined by their longings in a very shallow sense. Maybe a good question would be to ask, what is the manna in your life? What are the maybe miraculous or obvious daily bread types of provisions that God sends you repeatedly over and over? Maybe the other question, the bookend question, would be, what are the meat and onions that you find yourself craving instead? Well, let's move forward. Verse 18. You get to verse 18, you find out you better be careful what you ask for. So God comes back and he tells the people, consecrate yourselves in preparation for tomorrow when you will eat meat. The Lord heard you when you wailed, "If only we had meat to eat. We were better off in Egypt. Now the Lord will give you meat and you will eat it. You will not eat it for just one day or 2 days or 5 or 10 or 20 days, but for a whole month until it comes out of your nostrils and you loathe it." Don't you just love it when God gets mad? Especially when he's mad at somebody else. He says, I'm doing this because you have rejected the Lord and you have wailed before him saying, why did we ever leave Egypt? If you ever wanted to know how God feels when we are not thankful and we are not grateful for his provisions, this is a pretty good picture. And he tells them that in their ingratitude, they have rejected the Lord. Those of you who are quail hunters will get pretty excited about what happens in verse 31. Now a wind went out from the Lord and drove quail in from the sea. It brought them down around to the camp all around to about 3 feet deep above the ground as far as a day's walk in any direction. You got that? You got 3 feet of quail about 10 miles in every direction. That is quite the quotient of quail. And then a strange verse in verse 34. Therefore, the place was named Kibroth Hattaavah, because there they buried the people who had craved other food. Kibroth Hattaavah, we are told, means the graves of craving. You see, they buried there the people who got mixed up, the people whose craving drove them toward the ordinary God of meat and manna, the God of their choosing, their crafting, instead of the God of the manna. They leaned into the God of meat and onions, but they had disdain for the God of the miraculous manna. It would seem that they are the same as us. Our longings mark us out as to who we are, and if we have the right longings, they build in us a craving for God and for Jesus Christ. But if they're the wrong longings, don't miss this. They take us to the graves of our craving. We've talked in John 10 about the abundant life that Christ offers, the more better, fuller life that is available only along that pathway of truth by following Jesus, the Good Shepherd. Christ wants us to have it. We have identified some of the lying thieves who would steal it from us. Position, possession, prestige, power, we've named them. Performance, prosperity, pleasure, personal autonomy, protection. The list goes on. Funny, isn't it, how closely these thieves parallel with and resemble the longings of many? We talked last week about, at the very heart of this matter of needing something more in life, about the only true source which can satisfy that craving and scratch that particular itch. There's one thing. There's one direction. Jesus said, blessed are those who hunger and thirst after righteousness, for they shall be filled. That woman at the well was trying, just like everyone else, just like often we try, to scratch the itch. What we need in life is the peace of Christ in our hearts and the security and satisfaction and joy that it brings. But instead of the peace of Christ and the ability to be content and satisfied in His abundant provision, most of us have settled for a piece of the American pie. Bigger house, faster car, different job, a newer mate, more toys, you name it. Well, why is this important as we are still in the early weeks of a new year? Why is this in any way revolutionary? Well, let's spend the time we have left talking about the issue of identifying our thirst and longings. And the reason we need to identify them is because more of the same will never bring change. And if we've been on the wrong pathway for a long time and we do not change, we'll continue and we'll just get further and further away from the pathway of truth. Where we end up in life tomorrow is determined by what we crave today. Okay, do you understand that? Where we end up in life by December of this year will be determined by what we are thirsty for in February. So this is important in the beginning of a year to know where we're headed. We identify our longings, our thirst, and our cravings because these are what will define and determine the course of our lives. So we're kind of back to the same choice that we outlined last week, the choice between two pathways. There's so many unworthy and false goals out there. There are so many things which cannot satisfy. If we crave meat and onions, the seemingly desirable and better things the world has to offer us, instead of craving manna, the perfect, abundant, all-sufficient provision of God, we will end up, along with our meat and onions, in the graves of our craving. But oh, how we crave our meat and onions. It's interesting. It's a really damnable part of human nature. We crave so often what we cannot have, and at the same time, we despise or disdain what we do have. 2-year-olds do that all the time, but so do 20-year-olds and 40-year-olds and 60-year-olds. We find ourselves in this satanic battle on different fronts. We crave a promotion at work. We crave a bigger paycheck or more power, while we tend to moan and whine about our present job, our poor benefits, our lousy supervisors. I tend to drive older cars. I've got 2 cars. I have a 2007 RAV4 that is beat to snot with hail. And I've got a 2001 Tacoma. I wanted a Tacoma for a long time, but the Lord must have known that He needed to give me an old one instead of giving me the brand new shiny one that was in my mind. And I'm glad for my cars. They get me there quite easily. The insurance is way cheaper. They just serve the purpose that is required. I don't have to worry very much about keeping them looking new. But the only time I do worry about my 2001 Tacoma is when I pull into a parking lot and I'm next to a 2015 or 2021 Tacoma. And then mine doesn't look so good. The things we crave make the things that we have look pretty sad in comparison. As we fantasize about maybe what it would be like to have a younger, firmer, more affirming, more exciting wife, or a handsome, more sensitive, yet studly husband, our own mates lose the battle without ever having even had the chance to compete. If we imagine belonging to a church that's bigger, maybe, or has more exciting programs and different options, or maybe a faster pastor or a less sinister minister, just a matter of time until our present church doesn't meet my needs anymore. We can hear God telling us, manna is good for you. It's all that you need. And I think we know. Our mothers said much the same thing when they made us eat things like peas and spinach. It makes perfect sense. Those who are bigger than we are and smarter than we are know better than we do what is good for us. But oh, how we crave our meat and onions, even to the grave. The late great commentator Paul Harvey tells a story about how an Eskimo kills a wolf. First, the Eskimo coats a very sharp knife with animal blood and allows it to freeze. And then he adds another layer of blood and another until the blade of that knife is completely covered with a sheath of frozen blood. Next, the hunter takes the knife and fixes it firmly in the ground, blade up. And time takes care of the rest. Eventually, some wolf will follow his sensitive nose to the source of the smell. And he will discover the bait, and he will begin to lick it, tasting the fresh blood. He begins to lick faster, more and more vigorously, his warm tongue lapping on that blade until very quickly the keen edge is bare. Feverishly, harder and harder, the wolf licks the blade into the Arctic night, and so great becomes his craving for blood that the wolf does not even notice the sharp sting of the naked blade on his own shredded tongue. Nor does he realize that his insatiable thirst is being satisfied by his own warm blood. His appetite drives him. He craves more and more until the dawn finds him dead in the snow, defined by his longing, now in the grave of his own craving. When my kids were little, I hope they learned a little bit about this. We tried to teach them the difference between needs and wants. It gets pretty confusing, doesn't it? I'm on Amazon pretty often, Amazon thinks all of them are needs, and they have learned how to cater to my wants. But if we come to terms with our longings, usually we will find out that what we want and what we really need are oftentimes two very different things. Some people who are starved for love will look for it in an illicit romance, or a trashy novel, or a double cheeseburger, or in the arms of anyone who will listen and hold them for the night. Some people starve for acceptance, such as gang or cult members, will go to any end to belong to the group, even if it means killing someone or killing themselves. Some people starve for significance, will sell their souls to the company store, working 80-plus hour weeks as they struggle to climb the rungs of a corporate ladder. Each of them are like the wolf. They have a strong craving, a deep thirst. They just don't realize until it's often too late that this craving will not be satisfied before it kills them. It is not the path to peace. It is a path to destruction. It is the path of the lie. And their own revolution will see them destroyed. So yes, it is true. God made each of us with longings. He made us with needs. He made us with thirsts and hungers. All of us have cravings. All of us have these universal drives. And if we can look beyond the meat and onions the world offers, we will find what we were really needing all along. We need to join Jesus at the well. The woman in Sychar, she had tried everything else. She had tried religion and romance and relationships. We have to go to the Bible to find the answer, though, to our deepest longings. The psalmist gives us a clue. The psalmist understands this. Psalm 42, as the deer pants for streams of water, so my soul, Lord, pants for you. My soul thirsts for God, for the living God. Psalm 63 says, O God, you are my God. Earnestly I seek you. My soul thirsts for you. My body longs for you in a dry and weary land where there is no water. The ancient church father Augustine, interestingly, Joe Biden quoted Augustine at his inauguration. Augustine once wrote, you have made us for yourself, and our souls are restless until they rest in you. Psalm 107 tells us that God satisfies the thirsty. And most of us know Psalm 23. The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. He makes me lie down in green pastures. He leads me beside still waters. He restores my soul. The Bible is filled with those pictures of perfect peace and perfect provision. And there are many, many more, but you get the point. The source of the living water that Christ was offering to the woman at the well that day is the same source of everything and the only thing which truly and completely satisfies. The old philosopher Pascal once wrote this, what else does this craving, this helplessness proclaim but that there was once in a man a true happiness of which all that now remains is the empty print and trace. This he tries in vain to fill with everything, seeking in things that are not there the help he cannot find in those that are, though none can help, since this infinite abyss can be filled only with an infinite and immutable object, in other words, by God himself. See, the void within us is God-shaped, only to be filled perfectly by God. All of us are craving the same things. All of us are craving the God who created us in His image. God created each of us with an inborn longing that can only be fulfilled by the healing, utterly satisfying food of His presence in our souls. And this God-given, God-satisfied, holy hunger draws us to Him for the cleansing, completing, enfolding revolution of His perfect love and total acceptance. It is the only pathway to peace. Jesus told the woman at the well, whoever drinks the water that I give will never be thirsty again. She believed him. Her life was revolutionized, and she became a revolutionary for him after that day. Jesus said, "Blessed are those who hunger and thirst after righteousness, for they shall be filled." Well, let me ask you, in the midst of all of your manna, are you still craving the meat and onions? Let me just remind you that God has everything you need. He has already given you everything you need at this moment and this place in your life. He is completely able and capable to meet every need that you will ever have. I guess the real question is, do you want it? Pray with me. Father, we understand that we are easy marks when it comes to the tricks of the crafty one, Satan. And a lot of us have spent a lot of time licking the blood off of that knife. And some of us, it has taken to terrible places. And only by your grace have we escaped. Lord, there are many others of us who maybe don't go to that extreme, but every single day we let our thirsts, we let our longings drive us and define us in directions away from you. Really, what we're trying to do is satisfy the need and scratch the itch that can only be satisfied by you. But we forget that. So, Lord, I pray as we continue to consider the revolution that Jesus works, let me ask, let each of us pray that that revolution continue in our hearts and that we be the first in this revolution who are changed in such a way that it will change everything that we do and everything that we think. And maybe most importantly, it will change everything that we want. It's in the name of Jesus Christ we pray. Amen.
Hey, church. We're so glad you tuned in today. If you need prayer or if you have questions about what it means to follow Jesus, you can message us on Facebook or visit our contact page on our website, wacconline.org. If you're interested in joining our church family, we have the next steps available for you on our website as well. And remember, we are real people experiencing real grace. Thanks for joining us. We'll see you next week.